Okay, shall we begin? I think there's a good chance, if I spend long enough talking about reflecting judgment this week, that I'll get a seminar of 7 or 8 next week. It's immensely difficult. So you're all very brave to be here. In fact, I want to calm some anxieties, because a couple of people wrote me emails and said that if Allison was the commentary, could they have a commentary on the commentary? Because the problem of reflective judgment is immensely difficult. We are starting off on the very deep end of the problem, and nothing we're going to do is going to be any more difficult than what we're going to do over the next 2 weeks. And what we're going to do over the next 2 weeks is going to set the terms for what we do in the rest of the semester. But it is difficult. So don't panic. It will all come out all right. Okay. Let me summarize where we got to at the end of last week. I suggested that the general strategy of Kant's entire philosophy was the Copernican turn, and I said that the Copernican turn was Kant's view of the critique of metaphysics. That the Copernican turn was a turning away from the idea of our being able to attain a God's eye point of view on the world. And to say that we're unable to have a God's eye point of view on the world is equivalent to saying that we cannot see the world as a whole. We cannot see the world as unconditioned, that we cannot see the world as a totality. That, to use Heidegger's idea, we cannot make the world fully present to ourselves. So this is really the critique of presence. It's the idea that we are finite knowers. So one other way, Kant's way of saying it, is to say we cannot know the world as a thing in itself. The Copernican turn, then, is a shift or radical reorientation in which we move, to use some trite old but useful ideas, from a closed world to an infinite universe, but also from the idea of knowing the infinite to infinite knowing, knowing without end. Knowing without end, infinite knowing, is position of finitude. It's finite knowing. Now, to talk in terms of finite knowing, to say that we cannot have a God's eye point of view is equally to say for Kant that there is not one even human perspective on things. That our engagements with the world are themselves perspectival. And the simplest way of saying this is Kant thinks there are two irreducible and necessary perspectives that all human beings must have in their orientation to the world. Namely, the perspectives of being agent and of being a spectator. And what we've been talking about is the spectator's perspective, or what is sometimes thought the third person point of view, viewing things as objects, And this will contrast with, what I'm going to pick up in a couple of moments,
the first person point of view,
the view of ourselves as engaged agents in the world.
So this is the standpoint of subjectivity. This is the standpoint of objectivity. And for Kant, these are, again, both irreducible to one another.
You can't totally capture what's important about the agent's way of encountering the world from a third-person scientific, epistemic point of view, nor can you have everything from the point of view of the agent. Trivially, just to see this, you might well want to predict, those of you who have seen me teach before, that at some point in this lecture, you're going to predict there's going to be a very bad joke. It's a safe prediction, right? I cannot predict there's going to be a bad joke. Rather, I spend up late nights deliberating and concocting and intending to have bad jokes, right? So my perspective is incommensurable with yours, right? You have a predictive relationship to me as agent. I necessarily, right, unless I am B.F. Skinner, right? Well, that's what B.F. Skinner wanted to do. He's going to predict that B.F. Skinner is going to get up at 6 o'clock. Well, why? He cheats because he set the alarm at 6. You know, I mean, all that crazy stuff. So Kant's way of doing this, this is the goal to guarantee that there are these two perspectives, I said, is to regiment the perspective of knowing that it is above all a point of view. It is determined by the necessity of the way in which we must think about the world in order to have objective knowledge. And what Kant showed is that there are a certain number of presuppositions that any knower must have. Even if they are wholly unaware of it, they're operating with it all the time. Namely, they must, as I suggested last week, construe the world as being unified spatially, unified temporally, so we all belong to one space and one time, which is to say that for anything to exist, it must be somewhere and somewhen. And it must be a substance, and that substance must causally interact with all other substances, both at one time and through time. That is, there must be causality. That's the categories. That determines our concept of an object in general. But since our concept of an object in general, the object of judgment, is equally our concept of a world or our concept of nature, right? All those are, for Kant, intertranslatable. Now, because we determine that categorical structure, then Kant says we know appearances only and not things in themselves. That is, this is just a stance, albeit a necessary stance. That's the first element of the Copernican term. So Kant does two things simultaneously. He both grounds or founds the categories necessary for Newtonian science and simultaneously shows that that way of looking at the world is not complete or universal, but rather just the objective standpoint. So he both grounds Newtonianism and limits it. And of course, in saying this, in saying that we're restricted to this point of view, Kant is equally doing what will come to be the Kantian trick in a way for other domains, namely the limits of knowledge. We can only know things as appearances, are equally the conditions of possibility. So that finitude is not a loss. Finitude is not a restriction. Finitude is not a privation. Right? And it's not only because the limits of knowledge, our stands, are equally the conditions of possibility that open or reveal or expose or articulate our having a world at all. The second perspective, the one that he puts forward in the Critique of Practical Reason and in the Foundations of the Metaphysics of Morals, again depends on a Copernican turn, again depends upon finding a way of overcoming the debate between empiricism and rationalism. And to remind you, right, what I said last week, the reason why empiricism and rationalism, one of the two things they share, is they are both, in their different ways, forms of realism, which is to say they think there's a thing in itself. And the difference between rationalism and empiricism is rationalists think we can know it, empiricists think, not so well. But they both actually are fully committed to the realist picture. In ethics, the debate is between, say, a Hobbesian form of empiricism, where what is good is what I desire, versus moral rationalism, where one does the objectively impersonal good. Now, the simplest way of setting up Kant's Copernican turn here is to ask ourselves the question, assume there is a good. The good is described realistically. You can think of it in any way you want. It can be the greatest happiness for the greatest number. It can be principles of given by Moses in the Ten Commandments. It can be any rational input you like. The question we want to ask, assuming the good is a real object, is simply this. What is the relationship between my desire and the good? Now, there are just two possibilities here. Either I'm contingently related to the good, or I'm necessarily related to the good. That's it. That's exclusive possibilities here. Now, what if I'm contingently related to the good? Well, that's a problem, because then it means that morality is wholly contingent and accidental. Above all, it means there are no obligations, because I cannot be obligated to the good if I don't desire the good. I don't know anything about it. So if my relationship to it is contingent, then there's no obligations. Okay, so we want obligation. So let's say I'm necessarily related to the good. But then I have no freedom. If I am determined to desire the good and cannot desire otherwise, then there's no freedom, and therefore there's no morality either. So either view ends up entailing, and I mean that for Kant, every previous morality, Plato, Aristotle, all the medievals, Hume, Hobbes, all of them actually made morality impossible. Either because they were deterministic or because they were contingent. Kant's solution properly stated, Kant thinks that what we must demonstrate, if what I've said now makes any sense, is that we are both obligated to do the good and we are free. And here again, Kant's strategy is to relocate the formally metaphysical object, the good, into the structure of the mind. And the structure of the mind here involves a law of reason. And that law of reason is called the categorical imperative. The categorical imperative states, act only on that maxim through which you can at the same time will that it should be a universal law. Act only on that maxim through which you can will that it be a universal law. Well, that is hardly sounds like the solution to all the problems of ethics. But it certainly comes damn close, and here's why. First of all, I want to say that this really is a principle of reason because it stipulates only what is involved in acting consistently. That is, the categorical imperative stands to action as the law of non-contradiction stands to statements or sentences. That is, it is a minimal normative rule for consistency in action. Now, if that's right, and I'm going to try to convince you of this in a minute, if that's right, then Kant can hold that this requirement is a requirement for all rational beings. Even God must act on the basis of a categorical imperative. However, God is not obligated by the categorical imperative, and the reason God is not obligated by the categorical imperative, at least rumor has it, is because he does not suffer sheep. The dealer does not suffer temptation. In order to suffer temptation, there must be a competing source or spring of action, and that's that we are sensuous and desiring beings. So we are the kinds of being who have two independent springs of action, two different sources that motivate us to action, namely our desires and reason. And therefore, it's important for Kant that reason be independently motivating. So the reason that the moral law, which is again nothing more than the law of non-contradiction for action, the reason that for us it's an obligation is because we are sometimes tempted to act inconsistently, to act against it. Now, the law of non-contradiction and the categorical imperative are merely formal. They are pure forms with no content of their own. So the question is, and here's the mystery, how can something that has no content of its own nonetheless be the source of morality? Well, take a look at your handout. The practical deliberation one I handed out last week. If you don't have it, here's some more. Oh, it's early that way. Life in the fast lane. I am 99% sure that I stole this from John Rawls. For years, kind of interesting in itself, Rawls wrote out every single word of his lectures in longhand because he had terrible stutter. And then again, because he had this stutter, he put all his, in the kind of reading room in the Harvard Philosophy Department, all the lectures were there, the handwritten things, and they circulated for decades. Most of them are now published, and they're wonderful because Rawls was absolutely meticulous in this. It's just that every interesting philosopher turns out to be John Rawls, but beside that, he was really a wonderful reader, and I urge you to read his essays and lectures on the history of philosophy, really the history of ethics. They're terrific. Okay. So, yeah, I had a friend who stole them and copied them, and they were distributed. I'm pretty sure I got this from him. And he says that... the first thing to say about the categorical imperative is, for Kant, morality is not a spectator sport. Morality is telling you what to do.
Is this what seems to me an archetype? Is this a priori?
Yeah.
Okay, but then the source of it is not in the material world. The source is from somewhere else, obviously, and that's probably... motivation.
I've already said, in the mind.
Right, but that's not. But the thing is, if it's in the mind, like, does it come from God, like Leibniz would say, or would
No. It's so minimal; it doesn't have to come from anywhere.
But it's a universal law that everyone has.
Right.
Okay.
Because it's a minimum ground of intelligibility, which we discover through action. So, in the same way, we discover. So, for Kant, the only things that are innate are the logical functions of judgment and the moral law. And he says we discover the moral law, right, by a very, very simple way. And the example he gives is in the Critique of Practical Reason. And for Kant, it's the raciest moment in all of Kant. Kant, but of course... also written euphemistically, right? He says, there's this guy who is standing, you, he says, not some guy, you are standing outside a house in which you know you will have all your desires fully satisfied. And then he says, however, in order to go to this house, you will have to tell a lie to a friend. Now, Kant says, why make pleasure easy, right? Of course, all pleasure is betrayal. Kant says, all we have to imagine, and this is all we need for ethics, is that you might be tempted not to go in the house. That you'd be tempted to the good. And that temptation is enough to demonstrate that there is a motivation that is wholly independent of your desires. Right? And he thinks that he is just spinning out what is already there in our forms of action. Now, what I do when I'm going to cash it out, I'm going to explain why it has some content. But yeah, it's innate or a priori. Of course, that's the only way we're going to get it. In fact, no one ever thought of it until Kant exposed it. But he does reveal it through a kind of dialectical process. If you want to kind of see, the best account of that is from a former student of mine, Phil Stratton Lake's book on Kant. It does a beautiful job of showing how the categorical imperative can emerge in a kind of method of discovery, in a kind of dialogic way. So what it's going to be is what we want from ethics for Kant is a form of deliberation, how to deliberate about what to do. And the form of deliberation has two steps. The first step says we always deal for Kant with maxims. Maxims are, I want this, it's so complicated, but just take it that maxims are broad intentions. So I intend to do X in circumstances C to achieve some Y. And the first step in all action is not the categorical imperative, but the hypothetical imperative. And the hypothetical imperative says, you must, if you really intend the action, then you must have an idea of at least the necessary and ideally a sufficient means for doing it. You cannot intend the end without intending the means. And that turns out, although it's, again, an imperative, it's an analytic truth. Why is it an analytic truth? Why is the hypothetical imperative analytically true? Ruby?
He's a logician just like Hegel and Leibniz.
Yeah, that's not the answer. I mean, but why is it? What makes it analytic? It sounds surprising that this heavyweight thing, you must intend the necessary and ideally the sufficient means. Why is that analytic truth about intending to do X? Yeah, but I'm asking, why must it? Where's the must come from?
Otherwise, it's unintentional. We just spend the virtue of how we define a virtue has to involve.
All right. Anything else would be a wish, or a musing, or a dire hope, you know. But, you know, so people say, you know, I intend to be a doctor, you know, and then they go and sit in front of the TV and eat lots of popcorn. And what do you mean you intend to be a doctor? Well, I really, really would like it if I woke up tomorrow morning. I just graduated from Harvard Medical School, right? It's not an intention, it's necessarily the means. And once you've done that, then the act is rational. And the second step for Rawls is that it be reasonable. And this is the crux. This is the categorical imperative procedure. So I start with the maxim. And the second step in the reflective procedure is I generalize it, and I ask, and I say, what would happen if everybody acted on this maxim? So take the kind of standard Kantian example. You know, I borrow, you know, $5 for a cup of coffee. You know, Starbucks is expensive. I probably won't even get you a fancy latte thing, will it? But I don't intend to pay it back. So I now universalize my maxim and say everyone who borrows funds in as convenient doesn't pay them back. And then the next step is to ask, what are the likely consequences of this new law of nature? Because what I've done is shown that my will is legislative. I'm saying what I will, I'm legislating for everyone. What would happen if everyone did it? The new situation, Rawls calls the new perturbed universe, the universe in which nobody pays back their funds that they borrowed. And of course, we know what would happen immediately. We'll just finish and then we'll ask a question. What happened is, no one's going to lend anyone money. The whole institution of borrowing would break down. That is not the problem. The problem is a contradiction. Because I am willing to absolutely opposite states of affairs. I am both willing that everybody continues to pay back what they borrow, and simultaneously, in my very action, I am willing the opposite state of affairs. So I am literally in a contradiction with myself. So what the categorical imperative reveals is an actual contradiction in my action. I am both willing to, simultaneously willing to, contradictory states of affairs. Now, the reason that this is powerful, as everyone has noticed, is because it shows that in immoral activities, I am making an exception for myself. I am excluding myself from the rump of mankind and using everyone else for my private purposes. Or to say it another way, all immoral action is a form of free riding on the goodwill of others. So it looks like this notion of universality is part of literally the grammar of human action, but at the same time, it seems to capture a deep moral intuition, namely in acting, we must treat all others as agents like ourselves and never merely as means to satisfy our private desires. All of that from consistency in action. There was a question? Yeah?
Yes. So the question is sort of a comment, but everyone borrowed $5 from someone else, the system would equalize itself.
It's not about... You get the universality. No, absolutely right. It's everyone, when convenient, borrows money and does not return it. It's not the idea that everyone borrows. We're universalizing is the significant content of our maxim, right? Which is why I said the question of maxims is one of the deepest in Kant, because we have to figure out what is the deep content and what would be a trivial way of getting around almost lots of criticism of Kant depend on cooking the maxims, right? So there's a huge literature on making... As you tried to do, yeah. You know, or you make them more peculiar, you know. I'm not going to borrow money as convenient. I'm going to borrow only from the person in the front row of the... Right? So make it overly particular. And then, of course, it's universalized. Nothing happens except somebody gets broke, right? One guy. That's all right. Ruby?
So that's the contradiction that makes me in the
letter. No. Categorical imperative is not analytic, right?
No. The
contradiction.
Yeah.
It's just a contradiction. Yeah. It's just a contradiction.
But the thing is, it's like riding on A is not A.
Absolutely. Like, for actions. And yet it has all this content. Yeah. Exactly right. Okay. So again, I just want the purposes here. Just the point is the Copernican term. To give us an irreducible standpoint. Another way of saying this, if I have not, is to say that concept of a categorical imperative is equally, and it's a shocking thing to say, the law of freedom. Why is that? What he means by this is that only by acting in accordance with the categorical imperative as an independent spring of action, is it possible for me to have my actions as self-determined and not determined by something outside me? And he takes it that if I always act on the basis of my desires, right? Then it's not me that's acting. I'm not deciding what to do. It's my desires that are deciding what to do. And if we want to consider ourselves as free, then we need a way of detaching ourselves from our desires and judging which of them are worthy to be acted on, and therefore to act consistently on a principle that keeps us free from the hidden springs of desire, right? Or, if you wish, the unconscious. And Kant was perfectly aware. He says... He was an interesting kind of skeptic. He says, we do not know if anyone ever has acted on the basis of the categorical imperative. Because our hearts are dark. We do not know what the real motives of our action are. We do not know the news, right? But all we can do is intend the right thing. And to intend the right thing is to intend to act in accordance with the moral law. Hence, only by acting in accordance with the moral law, the batteries run down. Can my action be free, which for Kant means autonomous, that is, I give the law to myself and I do not follow the law of another, including the laws of nature, whatever. Okay. In this way, Kant has accomplished what he set out to do, namely simultaneously grounding and refounding the rationality of Newtonian science and showing the freedom of the will. Kant, of course, does not know, we cannot know, that we are free. And Kant says no one knows, right? Freedom is not an object. Freedom, I want to be careful here, freedom is actually only available to us from the first person point of view. Freedom is utterly, for trivially reasons, right? Unavailable to us from the third person point of view. So to say that we don't know that we're free, what we must think about is rather this, that we must act always as if we are free, and we are entitled, right, to think of ourselves as free from a practical point of view. And what I mean by that is exactly the way I did it with the bad joke. Namely, I cannot predict my own behavior, but must deliberate and intend. And once I'm in the standpoint of deliberating and intending, then I'm necessarily in that agent point of view, and therefore I am necessarily committed to the whole Kantian apparatus. So for Kant, the whole business of the moral law constitutes the first person point of view in general. It's what it is for anyone to adopt the agent perspective. But now, and this is all I want to do by way of introduction to the third critique, this sets up a radical dualism. In the section 2 of the published introduction, page 176, Kant puts it this way. The published introduction.
Oh, published.
Yeah. Second introduction. 176. The very beginning of 176. Hence, an immense gulf is fixed between the domain of the concept of nature, all this stuff, and the domain of the concept of freedom, all this stuff. So that, and here's now the puzzle, no transition from the sensible, by which he means this, to the supersensible, freedom, is possible, just as if they were two different worlds, the first of which cannot have any influence on the second. So he's given us these, you know, his strategy had been to divide and conquer, right? To save freedom by limiting the objective world and putting it in this independent perspective. But he realizes this raises a puzzle. He says, yet the second, the freedom, is meant to influence the first. That is, when I act morally, I actually intend to change the sensible world. I intend to make you happy, right? I intend to treat you virtuously and well, sometimes. But whatever I intend my actions are not only my ideas in my head, but things I want to realize in the world. The concept of freedom is to actualize in the world of sense the purpose enjoined by its laws. Hence, it must be possible to think of nature as being such that the lawfulness in its form will harmonize with at least the possibility of the purposes we are to achieve in nature according to the laws of freedom. That is, he says, if morality is to be possible, it has to be actualizable in the world. But to imagine that it's actualizable in the world means we have to imagine, at least we have to be able to think the possibility that the laws of nature, Newtonian science, does not make the realization of morality impossible. And nothing we have seen thus far, he says, has shown that. So, he hypothesizes here, there must, after all, be a basis uniting the supersensible that underlies nature and the supersensible, the concept of freedom contains practically, even though the concept of this basis does not reach cognition of it either theoretically or practically, and hence does not have a domain of its own. So he says, implausibly, by the way, this is the most implausible idea in all of Kant, that if this is to be realized here, then we have to imagine that underlying the two of them is some third supersensible domain that would allow us to think about how they were united. Now, I will talk about this, but not a lot. It is one of the motives for this book, but it's its least plausible idea for reasons I'll come to. Yeah?
How close?
Hegel's philosophy begins with Kant's third critique.
Yeah.
Sure. Yes. Sure. Okay. Nonetheless, I want to do the nonetheless. Kant's two perspectives here raises a problem. And it raises a problem in all sorts of ways. The first is exactly how do we make sense of these two absolutely exclusive domains? A domain of freedom that's, as it were, in the head, in the mind, in intention, and a domain of causality that is everywhere else. How does that harmonize? Sometimes, Cavell quits somewhere when Kant says, you know, I've had to limit knowledge in order to make room for freedom. But freedom is only this idea of acting under the moral law. Cavell says, thanks for nothing. This way of selling it may be deeply unsatisfactory. Secondly, and more to the point, it should immediately give us a tremendous question about the nature of art and aesthetics. If this stuff says what is and talks about the truth, how the world is, and this talks about how the world ought to be, what's left over? If one of them says everything about there is to say about how the world is, and the other says everything there is to say about how we would like the world to be, how it ought to be, then exactly what isn't said, the way in which Kant has carved up this space, prima facie, it looks like there is no room for art to do anything whatsoever. Indeed, he seems to have made sure that there's no place for it. He seems to have exhausted the possibilities of thinking about the world. So the first thing I want to do this evening is say that he hasn't. Before that, I want to do one last thing before we have a break. And that is, I want to continue the theme of the Copernican turn with the notion of judgment. Here, in the Critique of Judgment, the duality that Kant is thinking about is again pretty obvious. Namely, either beauty is in the eye of the beholder, in which case it's pure subjectivity, or beauty is determinate according to some rule. That is, there's some factual fact of the matter that determines whether an object is beautiful. So we can say either your lavender mist is or is not beautiful for each viewer independently of any other, or there's some ultimate matter of fact, some real something out there that we can point to that would determine whether it was beautiful or not. That is, beauty is a real property. So, the duality seems either beauty is in the eye of the beholder, or beauty is factually objective and determinable by some rule. Well, unsurprisingly, no one's ever discovered a rule of beauty. And I guess lavender mist would be a tough example to demonstrate exactly what the fact of the matter is.
Sort of formalism.
Well, Kant's is going to be a form of formalism, but for reasons I'll come to. Kant thinks that aesthetic judgments indeed are either right or wrong. Hence, they are objective. In that sense, he agrees with traditional rationalism. However, and this is what makes his view so startling, he eagerly believes there are no rules for determining this. Hence, that there is an ineliminable moment of subjectivity. Now, it matters that the third critique is called a critique of judgment. That is, unlike previous aesthetic theories or theories of the beautiful, he is shifting his focus again from the object, the realist way of doing it, to the judgment about certain kinds of objects, the ones we find beautiful. So the Copernican turn again is to look at not the thing itself, beauty, but our capacity for judging beauty. And in thinking about our capacity for judging beauty, we necessarily have to take into account both features of the subject, that is, the character, nature, and qualities of their judging, and the features of the object that are the intentional correlates of that form of mental activity. So the object is brought in, but only now as part of a united subject-object structure. So the relationship between the judging subject and the object judge is what Kant's going to mean by a judgment of taste. The judgment of taste involves both a responding to an object, which is to say there is no beauty in the world independent of the kinds of beings who make judgments of beauty. In that sense, beauty is in the Baha'i of not the beholder, but of we beholders. Kant will even say this judgment speaks with the universal voice. So it involves indeed beholding, but a beholding and a comprehension of that beholding, that is, judgments of taste, are a particular understanding of ourselves as judgers, how we take our judgments, and what we're taking them to be is specified in our relationship to that object. So it is both a responding and a reflective comprehension of a responding in relationship to an object specified by that responding. All of this we're going to spend weeks on. But I'm just trying to get the Copernican way, what's called the anti-Platonic way. It's not that there are out there some beautiful objects, independently of the kind of being who makes certain types of judgments. Now, what will separate aesthetics from what so far sounds like psychology, and what is wrong with Paul Guire's first book, and did I even put it on the reading list? I did. But he reduces it to psychology. I mean, he spent years working on it. He just didn't get it at all. He's since been making amends, but I think it's a long apology. Anyway, what will separate aesthetics from psychology will be the fact that there are new a priori justifying grounds for the judgments of taste. That is, I will be able to not only show the character of these kinds of judgments, but to show that I'm a priori justified in making objective judgments like that. These grounds are the so-called principle of subjective purposiveness, and the contemplation of an object with respect to this principle is going to be this complicated story about the harmony or the free play of the mental faculties, but don't worry about any of that. Okay. So critique of judgment emerges in this seemingly airless environment. And the first thing we need to do is find out what space there is to breathe between the exhaustiveness of the first person point of view and the exhaustiveness of the third person point of view. What else is there to talk about, and how is talking about that going to be connected to these questions of art and aesthetics? Stop there. Any questions about where we are? All this was just a setup. We haven't started the book yet. This is kind of, you know, Tristram Shandy stuff, right? I can keep going and we can never stop.
Just a bit about the motivation. I mean, here I've got almost everything on this side. I've caught most of the world up. What's my motive? Is it something that I'm missing? I just want to be totally exhausted? Is that like, what's the motivation for seeking a third thing? He's got an ulterior motive is what I'm...
Right. And I've already suggested one, which I said I didn't like. Right? And the one was that this duality is too dualistic. That you can't have merely freedom here and objectivity here with no connection between them, because freedom is about changing the world. And therefore, there has to be a way in which we can talk about the way in which agents interact with the world. And Kant has not even got that as yet. So that's his overt motive. I'm going to try to convince you it was a late, bad idea that he thought of when he was almost finished writing the book. And he had a much better idea at the beginning.
Is it just justified because, like, from the categorical imperative, there's still this innate universal principle that we all share. Is that, like, what's going to happen?
Is it going to be like that?
Yeah. Like, how we can actually make these judgments and be justified and know that we are justified in making this.
We're going to need something like that, although, here's the problem. Great question. Exactly what's the a priori principle going to do? We've already got the principles that tell us everything we need to know about objects as objects. And we already have all the principles we need to have.
Are you going to bridge the gap?
Well, I just said, he says he might, but I'm skeptical. So it's a puzzle. Okay, good. We've got a puzzle. Let's have a break. Let's, as it were, live with the puzzle. And I'll come back and I'll try to de-puzzlefy a bit.